Thank you for coming again, and I'm looking forward to a time of Q&A. Any questions that you guys have, ask hard questions. This is the one opportunity that we all have to see if this marriage of sorts is going to work, so please don't hold back. I just want to share just a little bit about my testimony and just a little bit after that, just kind of where what the Lord has done in our lives and how he's led us to the point where we are. I was brought up in a Christian home. Every testimony starts like that, right? Except for those who weren't, of course. But I was brought up in a Christian home, and my parents had us in the Assemblies of God Church. So I grew up in the Assemblies of God Church up until about 13 years old. I was talking to one of the members yesterday, and he also is in the Assemblies of God Church. And I was telling him there's always that range, even in the Assemblies of God Church. There's the really crazy side where, you know, there's snake handling, all that kind of stuff. And then there's the other side that, you know, they have the tongue speaking, but they still have the gospel. And by God's grace, I was in a church where I did hear the gospel from time to time. So that seed was planted young, early on, and I was very grateful for that. But there was the weirdness, of course, and then on top of that, my parents just had a rough marriage early on. They were separated a number of times. My dad struggled with alcoholism and other things, and then I believe they were Christians. I believe they're Christians today, but perhaps what we might call nominal Christians. So we never had family devotions. We never sat around and read the Bible and prayed. We prayed from time to time, Christmas time. Maybe we'd do that a little bit more. But it was nominal. So I didn't get a huge exposure to a robust Christian theology. But I always had a heart that was, I guess you might say, desirous to please my parents, desirous to please church members in my life. So anyways, about 11, 12 years old, I guess it was 6th through 8th grade, I got a little more involved in the church, the Assemblies of God Church that we were in. And got involved with a youth group, very small youth group. And the church, the youth group leaders even asked me to be something of a leader in the youth group. And so that was kind of weird, but I went forward with it. And then those youth leaders left my 8th grade year. And I was really close to them. In fact, I think that was the main reason that I was there. And so when they left, I just thought, you know, it was time to move on. So starting my freshman year, I went to another church across the river. It was an evangelical free church. A lot of kids in the high that I was going to high school with were going to that church, so we went there and got exposed to, might call it Calvinism light, the four, 5 points of Calvinism, and I was really excited about it. I even got exposed to a little bit of the confessions and whatnot. But I was in high school at the same time. I had a girlfriend who was pretty crazy, and she really pulled me away from devotion to church life, and I held on my freshman year. Kept going to church, kept trying to be faithful, but the heart really wasn't there. And my sophomore year, I gave in. I kind of gave myself over to, like many teens do in high school, the kind of party life and that kind of stuff. So from my sophomore year to my senior year, I just was, I had walked away from the Lord, as I understood it, because I believed that I was saved before, so I believed that I'd walked away. So my eighth grade, or my senior year, it was graduation, went out and partied with a bunch of friends. Ended up getting pulled over for a DUI, an evasion of officer, ended up in county jail. And during that whole time, from my sophomore to my senior year, I had been trying to go back to church and trying to make it work because I had this feeling and sense of guilt that I knew what I was doing was not right. But I didn't have enough desire. That desire just wasn't there to bow the knee to Christ. I still wanted what the world was offering. So senior year, I find myself in county jail, and I had told my parents that night that I was going bowling with the church group. I mean, just a bold-faced lie, when in reality I'd gone partying. I get arrested. I'm in county jail, and it was a really low time for me. I had a lot of time to think in that jail cell because I was there for about 12 to 15 hours until next morning when my dad had to come get me. And I just realized that I was utterly lost. Like, I had no direction whatsoever. I was just giving in to my the fleshly desires and indulging them without any profit whatsoever. Like, there was no gain, no profit for what I was spinning my wheels on. And so I knew, again, enough of the gospel from that little Assemblies of God church that I just knew what the gospel was. I knew that the law told me that I was a wretched sinner that was in need of the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so right then and there, I prayed to the Lord and I said, Lord, I know that I'm a sinner. I don't deserve your grace, and I just ask you that you would give it to me because I believe in what your son has done. So I was saved then and there. It was a graphic moment for me because it was a drunk tank, and it was absolutely packed to the gills. I mean, everyone was in there that night. And there weren't, like, really sections in the jail cell. It was just one big jail cell. And in the middle, it's a little graphic, but there was a toilet. And the only spot for me to sit, the only space that was open, was at the foot of that toilet on the cold cement floor. And it was humiliating to be there. And what was even worse is that in the midst of sitting there, just trying to come up from something of a drunken stupor, some guy came over and started using the toilet right there. And it was a graphic picture of where my life had brought me. So from being rock bottom, the Lord was gracious to change my heart, and I trusted in him. I started going back to this church, this Evangelical Free Church, and got discipled by one of the pastors there. That pastor ended up leaving, and so the senior pastor kind of took me under his wing. So fast forward, I ended up finishing up community college and really getting involved in the church, just eating up the Word of God, trying to go to every single Bible study that I could, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, just I could not get enough of it. And my elders approached me, and they said, hey, Josh, you know, we really appreciate your involvement in the body, and we see some gifting in you, and we want you to consider going to Bible college and perhaps think about going into the ministry. So long and short of it, I took them up on that. It was a delightful surprise, and I was very grateful that they were willing to trust me in that. So I went to the Master's College in Southern California. As many of you know, that John MacArthur is the president of the Master's College. So I did my master's there. One of those semesters I studied in Israel for 4 months, and that was a wonderful experience. And then my bachelor's, yeah, master's college. And then after that, I graduated in 2001, and my elders approached me again and said, hey, look, we are looking to plant a Bible Institute in Ensenada, Baja California. And Ensenada, Baja California is about an hour and a half south of the San Ysidro border. So if you got San Diego, you go about, I don't know, an hour and a half south, get to the border, then you go another hour and a half, and that's Ensenada. Ensenada's kind of a tourist town. A lot of the Carnival cruises port in that town. So you have the tourist section, and then you have the really poor section. I was in the poor section. So I told them, I said, you know, I'm done with college, and I have a scholarship to go to Southern Seminary. I really don't want to pass up this opportunity. I feel like I need training for the ministry. I need my MDiv. And they said, look, why don't you just go down for 6 months, get the institute set up. We want to train men to go out and be church planters in the Republic of Mexico. And after 6 months, we'll get somebody else to go down there if you want to go off to seminary, and we'll just move on. I said, okay, that's great. So I went down in the, January of 2003, and I stayed down there for 6 months, and I fell in love with the people there. It was a small Grace Brethren church, and there was a network of churches in this association of churches that were just passionate for the gospel, were planting churches left and right, were discipling people, were seeing a lot of growth. But in their system, in their network, their big kind of deficiency was they just didn't have sufficient training for these men. So a lot of times these men, out of zeal, would go out very excited to plant the church, disciple people, but would just burn out really quick or would fall into sin because they just weren't equipped for the ministry. So I fell in love with them. I was teaching through a translator for those 6 months. And at the end of those 6 months, I was supposed to go to Southern to start my MDiv, and I just, I was praying and talking through it with my elders, and I just said, you know what, there's a seminary in northern San Diego, Westminster Seminary, why don't I just commute there during the week and then come back and teach on the weekend? So that's what I did for 3 years. For 3 years, I was at Westminster Seminary in California. I was studying for my MDiv Tuesday through Friday. And then I'd drive back down to Ensenada, which was about a 2.5 to 3 hour drive. I'd teach Saturday through Monday. Sometimes in addition, I'd preach on Sunday morning. And then Monday night, I'd drive back. I'd usually get back to San Diego at about 1 or 2 a.m., then go to class in the morning. I did that for 3 years, and it was insane. I would never do it again. it was a good thing that I was single, because I would have destroyed my family if I did something like that. So towards the end of my time, the church sent this cute little blonde down to Ensenada, Baja California, to work with us to help develop curriculum. She had done a year abroad in Spain, and so she was very fluent in Spanish. It was my wife, Christina, and so she'd graduated with a BA in communication and a minor in Spanish from UC Davis. And so she was sent down by my church for 6 months, and she worked with the women there. She helped develop curriculum, and she taught some of my students to read and write Spanish, because some of them just didn't even know how to read and write, which was wonderful. So we worked a lot together and just really developed a wonderful professional relationship, and she was really lonely there. I was really lonely there. Besides her, the only friend that I had was my boxer named Daisy. She was like my best friend. And but when Christina came in my life, I started neglecting Daisy, and Daisy noticed that. She started getting a little jealous of Christina. But we really developed a wonderful professional relationship, but we also became great friends. She actually was in a relationship with another man at that time. And they ended up breaking up December of 2005. And in February of 2006, through a long chain of circumstances that I won't go into, my sending church ended up letting me go from my position in Mexico. The long and the short of it is they were dispensational, and going to Westminster Seminary, I became not dispensational, and so they decided to let me go. Really what was going on is that the head pastor had fallen into some major, major sin. I mean, like of epic proportions. Without going into a lot of details, he ended up becoming the power of attorney for an old man in the community, an atheist in the community, who had been a farmer all his life and wanted to build a museum showcasing the agrarian lifestyle of the Central Valley in California. But he didn't have any know-how whatsoever. He's just an old farmer. So he wanted to find a charismatic leader in the community that would be able to pitch the dream and sell it and get it going. And so he came to my senior pastor. He was the man, very charismatic, lowercase c man, who just was a born leader. And at first my pastor said no, but after this man kept nagging him, he decided to take it on. So he became the power of attorney, and he became authoritative, if you will, over $1.4 million. And instead of building a museum, he ended up buying houses for his kids and bought a house for himself, various other things, to the point where the money was almost completely gone. And one time he attempted to kill this man by driving into a tree. Just right into a tree. He claims that he fell asleep, but the man just was in the passenger seat and he broke his legs. He recovered a year later. He was quote-unquote driving down a canal, which is very common in the California area, and said he hit a rock. They went into the canal. The old man drowned. Very, very sad and despicable situation. It was very disillusioning for me. It was disillusioning for everyone in our church. There were people that ended up apostatizing. Because he was their Paul. And when Paul does something like that, what's the point of staying in Christianity? So when he left, a lot of people, he stepped down. He ended up going to jail. He's in jail, I think, in San Quentin right now. The church was just losing money, and so they had to let people go on staff. So I was let go, and the stated reason was for my theology. So anyways, very sad situation. I just praise God that he kept my faith during that time. And it's embarrassing to even say things like that, because we all like to think that our faith is strong, and, you know, especially as Calvinists, you know, quote-unquote, once saved, always saved, and he perseveres, he preserves us. And that is true if you're truly saved. But if you're not, you know, you're going to apostatize. And there were thoughts that I had, like, what, like, this man has deceived so many people, like, how is this authentic and real? But what it did is it lifted my eyes beyond human leaders to the chief architect of our faith, the Lord Jesus Christ, who said that I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And that promise has been true even through something as ugly as that in my life. So we left in February 2006. We ended up coming back to the Central Valley, California. We got married in July of 2006, started working as teachers at a Christian school in the area, and we were there in that area for about 3 years. We decided to pay off a lot of debt that we had from school. I did not finish my degree at Westminster at that time, and in 2010, so now 4 years later, we went back to Westminster, and we finished my degree. We were there for 3 years. I graduated in 2012. In 2012, 2011, 2012, we were trying to have kids. We had two miscarriages. And when I graduated in 2012, I really wanted to pursue the PhD, but it was just not good timing for my wife. She, after two miscarriages, she's just like, you know, I just need some time. So after I graduated in 2012, we stayed in San Diego for one more year. I taught at a classical school, fifth grade, history, Bible, logic, and some other things. When you teach at those schools, you kind of teach like six different things because they need you to do all these things. And then in 2013, we left San Diego, went to Louisville, Kentucky. I started a THM in Old Testament, and then the following year, I entered the PhD program. And long and the short of it, I have a desire to contribute to the academy, contribute to scholarship, but my heart is in the church because, you know, even as I was trying to convey this morning, Ephesians 3:10, the manifold wisdom of God is displayed to the heavenly rulers and authorities and to the earthly rulers and authorities through the church. This is where it's at. This is where the kingdom of God is proclaimed. This is where the kingdom work is done. And it's just my ardent desire to be used by God in any way I can to contribute to that, to serve the church, to serve Christ, and to hopefully further his kingdom in that work. So in January, I applied knowing that I was going to finish up my classes and comprehensive exams in the PhD program, because the PhD program very simply has three components. You do your classes, you do your exams, and then you have your dissertation. And your dissertation you could do anywhere, wherever there's a good library. So knowing that I had finished, was going to finish in May, my classes and my exams, I started applying to churches. And I saw Grace Covenant on the Southern Seminary Ministry Connections website, and I came home and told my wife, I said, this is perfect. I read the confession, I read the Constitution, the bylaws, your mission statement, what you guys were about, and I'm just like, bing, 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 down the list. This is who I am. I am reformed. I'm confessional. I love exalting Christ in the preaching of his word. I believe in the ordinary, simple means of grace as the normative way by which the Spirit works, and that's where you guys are at. And so I was telling everyone this today at lunch that I work for UPS, by the way. I drive one of those big brown delivery trucks. So one day, I guess it was about a month ago now, I was delivering in an area. I still remember exactly where I was. I get a call from Ken, and he told me that the Pastoral Search Committee had decided and that they had unanimously chosen to go with me. And I had to pull over. I mean, you got to pull over anyways. You can't drive a UPS truck and talk on the phone, but I pulled over into a park and literally I had to choke back the tears. It was a very, very emotional moment in my life. I was telling Ken, he probably thought I was a babbling fool because I'm just like, I don't know what to say. So we have just been very blessed by the whole process. Wonderful interview that we had with the Pastoral Search Committee. The search committee was wonderful throughout the whole time. So professional. And I just say that because we've been through a few candidacies and dealt with pastoral search committees that it's like, you know, the blind leading the blind. Nobody knew what was going on. And sometimes I wouldn't hear from anybody for months. And sometimes I wouldn't hear from anybody ever and just find out through hearsay, hey, they didn't go with you. You know, it's like, okay, great. So the pastoral search committee was wonderful, very, very professional. And like I said, when we got here, we've just been overwhelmed with the love that you guys have shown. So thank you so much. We are super excited to be here. And I would love at this moment to take any questions that you guys have. Yeah. That's a great question. Resume building is a nebulous enterprise, and a lot of times there are buzzwords that are used that need to be decoded. So let me decode that for you. What I mean by that is, bottom line is, I don't care what organization you're in, you need a leader, but specifically in the church, although the church is not a profession, okay, it still needs leaders that are going to be able to not only show and develop for the congregation what we're about now. So what is our purpose? What is our vision? What are our values? Okay. But even more important than that, the leader needs in some sense to be able to look forward into the future as much as possible. He's not omniscient. But be able to set a course for where the church is going. They need to be thinking about future leaders. They need to be thinking about guarding the deposit, the doctrine that we have from generation to generation. And so that means in the context of this local church, for example, if the Lord calls me here, we're always going to be thinking about who's going to be the next generation of leaders. And that doesn't start, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. It starts now. I mean, some of the children that are in our midst could be the next leaders of this church. And so the ministry that comes from this pulpit, the ministry that comes from the leaders, the elders and the deacons, the fellowship, everything down from the top to the bottom needs to be one that is about preserving the doctrine, the legacy, the priority of the gospel in those things. And that takes vision casting, like constantly telling people what we're about. So, for example, when I worked at a classical school, this classical school in San Diego, they were really big about that. And every year, their staff had to go through a training. It was about a one-week training on what our mission, vision, and values were. Mission, purpose, and values. Because they wanted every staff member to be able to say what we're about. What our pedagogy, our style of teaching is about, why we do it that way, why we don't do it a different way. So as that connects to a church, my desire, if the Lord would call us here, is that every member in this congregation would be able to say in a brief sentence what we're about. And that goes beyond just like, well, the Great Commission, right? Teach, go out, baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, teach them all that I have taught you, and lo, I'm with you always till the end of the age. That's important, but that command was given 2,000 years ago. How does that flesh out in Virginia Beach? Because it's going to take a particular shape. It's going to have particular contours in this context that it's not going to have in Louisville, Kentucky, that it's not going to have in San Diego, California. So by vision casting, that's what I mean, is like taking who we are as Christians universally, and if I can use this word, contextualizing it to this area, and then looking forward to see what that's going to look like in the future and taking steps along the way to try to make that happen. Does that help? Okay. That's a great question. It's a little higher than Louisville, right? She's the one. She can answer that. That's the she does all that stuff. So, yes, sir. What's your name?
Aaron.
Okay.
If somebody from ISIS walked in the door right now, what would our reaction be? So, what would you think are some of the benefits and perhaps drawbacks not being informed to having some of these experiences? How would you translate them into a ministerial reality?
Okay. Well, it's a good question. Let me think about that. I think over the past 10 to 12 years, especially having gone through seminary and then getting into ministry, a solid Reformed church in San Diego as an intern, and trying to play out many of the, like many seminarians do, trying to play out in everyday ministry a lot of the ideals that we have coming out of seminary, okay? So if I can explain that, I mean, this is a Reformed church, so a lot of times when you first became a Calvinist, did you go through the cage phase where you needed to be locked away in a, like, high security, detention area for probably, a few years until the foam cleared from your mouth and you settled down and you could be, around normal people, right? We've all experienced that, okay? Now, take that experience and now go to seminary, it's dangerous. Now you got a bunch of sharp tools and you really don't know how to use them, okay? So coming out of seminary, that's how I was. I was a stark, raving, mad Sabbatarian, and I thought everybody else needed to be. And I went to a church that would claim to be Sabbatarian, but they fleshed it out in a very, I think, realistic way. So trying to flesh out those ideals that theoretically worked in the cafeteria in seminary midweek, but on the ground on Sunday morning would drive people away. I learned, I think pretty quickly, probably not as quickly as I should have, but I learned quickly that there's got to be a translation that goes on. What you preach in a seminary chapel, for example, should not be preached perhaps at this pulpit. The kind of exhortation that goes on between seminarian and the highfalutin 50-cent word lingo that you get coming out of seminary shouldn't take place in a local church setting. So I think if I understand your question, the best way to answer it would be I've just learned to have patience with people. And I've just learned to try to find out what their agenda is, why they're here. Try to ask them a set of questions that's going to get at the nub of the issue. What are you looking for? Sometimes people come to church and their whole goal is to basically take it over. Some people come to church because they're hurting and they're broken. They've been through a bad relationship. Perhaps they've been betrayed. Perhaps they've suffered the loss of loved ones. And they're just hurting and wounded and they want hope. And they don't want a theological treatise. They want hope. And so I think what I'm continuing to learn to do, but what I'm grateful for the experience that I've had, which has shaped me and I hope taught me to do this a little better, is to just look for that. What are people looking for? And how, more importantly, at the end of the day, does the gospel speak to their particular situation? And there's a lot of talk about gospel this and gospel that today, and I want to be careful not to use a lot of those buzzwords, but the bottom line is it's good to be gospel-centered. And that's what I hope that we're about, is being gospel-centered. But then, taking that a step further, if you will, and talking about how that fleshes itself out in sanctification. Okay, I love Martin Luther, but one of the things that frustrates me about a lot of people that have only read some Luther is that they take kind of the worst parts of Luther and they shout those things. They don't read the other parts of Luther where he talks a lot about law-keeping, okay? And Lutherans, what are they known for? They're known for shouting justification and whispering sanctification, okay? And what I love about the Reformed tradition is that we try, well, everybody thinks they're balanced, right? So we think we're balanced. But we try to shout not only justification, but declare sanctification by the work of the Spirit and both all by grace, okay? So anyways, I mean, that might have been a little rambling. I don't know if that gets, you're welcome to ask a follow-up question if you want, but does that help a little? Okay. Yes. Scott.
church might look like, you know,
Yeah. That's a tough question because I want to be careful not to think too far ahead without the elders and the deacons. So I'll give a provisional answer to that. Some thoughts that, you know, if Ken and Brendan and the deacons want to qualify or jump in, that's more than welcome. My first year here, if the Lord calls us here, would principally and primarily be about just getting to know the congregation. That's the biggest thing, maybe even just the first 2 years. And in saying that, I'm not saying I'm not going to do other things, but I am saying I have no intentions to come in with like, you know, we're going to build a sports stadium and we're, you know, all, you know, we're, no, I just want to get to know the congregation. I mean, I want to know the people that I am serving, the people that I'm preaching to. It was very, very hard for me to preach this sermon this morning for the sole reason that I don't know the people I'm preaching to. And, you know, back in the day, you know, 10 years ago, I don't care. You know, truth is truth, and I'm just going to fire hose it to everyone. Well, no, I mean, you need to tailor your application to a people. And I want to see the gospel shine in all its brilliance in the midst of a community, but I can't do that unless I know the people, the problems, the tendencies, the idiosyncrasies, and the temptations that my people struggle with so I can speak to them. So the first thing would be about getting to know the congregation. Secondly, I want to just get on the same page with the elders. So I want to talk ecclesiology with the elders. We are pretty much eye to eye in how we understand our ecclesiology, our government, and stuff like that. But, you know, that's all on paper. I want to get in and I want to talk specifics. I want to give hypothetical scenarios. What would you do here? What would you do there? I understand that there has been some excommunications in the history of this church, so I want to learn more about that. I also understand that when Joe Gillum came, there was something like 14, 15, 16 people here, and now there's more. Let's put it that way. I want to learn more about how that happened, you know, in those 9 years, what was done to grow the church in that manner. And then the deacons, I think, Saturday I had a brunch with the elders and the deacons, and I was just tremendously blessed as the deacons were talking about all the ways in which they're literally serving widows and serving people in the church in physical ways. And it's just like coming right out of the pages of the New Testament, what deacons are supposed to do. I'm seeing it lived out here. So I want to learn more about that. I want to know how I can specifically, how we as the elders can minister to the deacons. But then now beyond all that, to try to get at your question a little bit, I, like I mentioned earlier, want to start thinking ahead about grooming future leaders. We need future leaders. I would say even in the size that we're in right now, I think we're going to be able to shepherd a lot better if we had an extra elder, you know? And as we begin to talk about what are ways that we could reach out to our community, and that's going to take some time to first off talk about evangelism and then kind of disabuse us of what we're not responsible for. And I just want to echo one thing I said this morning. I hope it's not a hobby horse that I get off on too much, but I, in the evangelical world, was a lot of times saddled with a lot of guilt because I wasn't as proficient of an evangelist as this guy who was clearly called to be an evangelist. And I've really kind of reacted from that, and I think biblically, as I read the pages of the New Testament, there are certain people that are called to be evangelists. There are certain people that are officially meant to be, or are called to be missionaries. And missionary comes from missive, the word where we get the word missile, one that is sent officially by the church. And so sometimes when you hear people, and I think with good intention, say things like, every Christian is a missionary. There's a sense in which that's true, but not in the official capacity. And I'm not, you know, splitting hairs here. That's a big difference because as a pastor, it's important for me not to saddle the consciences of my people with things that the Bible does not saddle their consciences with. And so on the one hand, I want to say, no, you're not meant to win as many souls as Ray Comfort, who, by the way, I had the opportunity to go and share the gospel with people with him in Santa Monica when I was at Masters in L.A., and it was a wonderful opportunity. But I couldn't share the gospel like that guy. I have not won as many souls, quote-unquote, as that guy. And I refuse to feel guilty for it because it's not what I'm necessarily called to. But secondly, the way evangelist is used in the New Testament, it principally refers to the work of a pastor. Paul tells Timothy, do the work of an evangelist. That happens right here in this pulpit. And that's why any pastor who's not preaching the gospel every Sunday in some sense is not doing the work of an evangelist. And so where the congregation comes in is bringing people to church so they can hear the evangelist preach the gospel. So as we talk about what evangelism means, and hopefully by God's grace, what I can do is try to, as I get to know everyone, see what work situations people are in, see what kind of people they're brushing shoulders with, tailor an application to how we can share the gospel in this area, and see what the Lord does with that. And if he begins to grow, that's when we're going to start talking about developing more leaders and grooming more leaders. And then another thing that even we were talking about today at lunch with the leaders is I have a desire, a great burning desire in my heart to reach the youth in our church. We're in an interesting situation as Reformed Baptists because we got our Presbyterian brethren whom we love and respect, but you know, their children are covenant children. You know, they're in the covenant, they're in the church. And I want to say I believe our children who do not believe in Christ are covenant children, but it's the covenant of works. It's the covenant with Adam. And what they need is they need the gospel. And what a wonderful privilege it is that in God's providence, he has, how do I say this, born them into Christian families so that they are exposed to the gospel. That is a wonderful situation that they're in. And it's incumbent upon us as the church to take full advantage of that situation and serve our youth by not only preaching them the gospel, catechizing them with the gospel, but by God's grace, living the gospel before them, even in our sinning and our failures, showing them what it looks like to ask even them forgiveness for raising our voice, for being a hypocrite, for, you know, whatever the case may be, and saying, you know what? This is why Christ came, because I'm a failure. Even your dad, even your mom were failures. So that our children, hopefully by God's grace, don't grow up and see the gospel and Christianity as just a system and religion of hypocrisy. So the kids, the youth, are a very, very important thing that I think needs to be addressed. And I want to talk more with the elders about how we can specifically reach our youth, you know. And, you know, we could talk until the cows come home about programs and stuff. I have no problem with quote-unquote programs. It's just, what do we mean by that? If what we mean by that is serving our youth and putting Christ before them, great. That's what I want to do. And that's going to take many different forms, and that's something that I would want to talk about. But to answer your question on that particular matter, it's something that is a burden on my heart and something that I would like to see built up here at Grace Covenant. So does that help? Would you like to add any follow-up questions? Okay. All right. Yeah. 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 So, that's good. We'll talk about homeschool and, or homeschool, home groups and Sunday school. So we in the churches and experiences we've been have seen a tremendous benefit to home groups. And I've talked to the elders. I know that you guys have done a little bit of that here. But in our mind, home groups serve a number of different functions. But one of the principal functions that they serve is, I know you guys are a Lord's Day church, which means you're principally here just here on Sunday. But if you have home groups, say every 2 weeks, what you're doing is you're getting in smaller doses exposure to concentrated fellowship where those bonds and those networks are being formed that are upping the accountability of the church and exposing one another to people's lives in a greater way so that if there is, for example, sin, it's going to register with people sooner. It's going to get up the chain of command, if you will, and there's going to be shepherding that comes to the rescue of those people that are perhaps walking off the path, if you will. You know, hopefully not. But also, where there needs to be encouragement or there needs to be edification, that too can go up the chain of the command as it gets exposed in the home group and people talk and we pray and the leaders find out, and then we can serve them more specifically. So the way I'd love to see home groups work is you have leaders that you have groomed to be over home groups, and that's going to be elders, deacons, and then other, you know, couples in the church that are just pillars in the church. And they're going to be, in a sense, almost under-shepherds, in the sense that they almost are like a leader to those people in seeking to disciple them. And then if there's any concerns that maybe they feel need to go to the elders, and they communicate to the elders, and the elders can address those things. And it just makes the process a lot smoother. With respect to Sunday school, I'd love to get a curriculum that maybe circulates every 3 years. So you're going through maybe the catechism or the confession or maybe a DVD series or whatever the case may be. You know, sometimes certain occasions and certain seasons require going through things specific. So maybe you do a series on money or something like that, okay? But to have a curriculum that's always there, apart from the seasonal stuff, so that we are constantly being reminded of, again, the deposit that we've been given and are earnest and desirous to uphold it and to keep it pure. I think that's really, really important. So those would be some concrete examples. Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. And to be honest with you, I'm going to have a better answer to that if the Lord calls us here and I just get plugged into what's going on. But I do believe, I think parachurch organizations are great. I think that the institution that the Lord has instituted is the church. And I think that as much as possible, we should try to make that the centerpiece of our evangelistic efforts. And that doesn't preclude or exclude parachurch organizations, but it does indicate a desire on my behalf to have parachurch organizations be, in some sense, beholden to the local church and see the local church as an important instrument in bringing about whatever evangelistic opportunity they have. So I don't know in this area what there is, so it's kind of hard for me to speak to that. But I guess the best thing, and this is not a very good answer, but the best thing I could say at this point is, as I get to know the congregation, I think one of the things that's going to arise is people are going to be revealed that have certain desires for certain people in the community. And what I want to do is I want to encourage those people as much as possible to pursue that ministry in any way they can. So if that means that the church gives financially so that they can do that, we want to be a part of that. If it means that the gospel in some way is going to be preached or communicated, whatever. And by the way, I don't think that that means, let's say, for example, in Louisville, we have, in our church, they support a bakery, right? That women who have come out of the adult entertainment industry and, you know, prostitution and stuff like that, that are trying to get out of that life, they need jobs. They need to start over. And so they started this bakery, and it's kind of together with this recovery house. And it's really helping these women get on their feet. Now, these women don't hear the gospel every single day. And sometimes even they'll take in a woman who's not even a Christian, but again, like Cornelius, is open to these things and wants to learn more. I have no problem with that. I think that's great. So it's one of those things. I'll use the typical example. I don't like this example, but the soup kitchen. Let's talk about the soup kitchen, okay? Everybody likes to talk about the soup kitchen when we talk about social ministries. I would have no problem if down the line we had enough money to have a soup kitchen to serve people on the street, but the gospel would have to be in there somewhere. Would it have to be in there every single time? Like as they're waiting in line to get soup, or like giving them tracts and making them read them, and before they get their bowl of soup, they have to recite what the gospel. No, I think that's overkill. So I don't think it needs to be overt, but I do think it needs to be in there, because here's the nub. I am very sensitive about losing the gospel in any social outreach that we have. And if you look at the history of the Baptists, and even in some Reformed circles, the desire to reach society so consumed them, and it was good that inadvertently a lot of people lost the gospel along the way. So the baseline of my answer is that I am open to a lot of ideas as long as the gospel is in there somewhere. Does that make sense? And I'd love to converse more with you. We had a little time to talk, and I'm very interested in what you do, so I would love to learn from you what thoughts you have on that as well. So.
Sometimes it may sound like, oh, I have to get to know the congregation and a cop out. But we've or like outreach events there, or there was just a fire in that particular apartment complex, and that was a great opportunity where our church was able to just send blankets and beds and pillows and, you know, and support the people there that are there trying to share the gospel. And so in this, you know, in your church, we know you have the Bartimaeus house going on.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I appreciate that. And I think the bottom line is we want things to be organic. That's another buzzword. But we want things to be organic in the sense that we don't want to try to push something that doesn't have momentum in the congregation. So you have to have those key figures who have those giftings to do those things. Because, you know, the leaders can't do everything. And by the way, you know, traditionally Baptists are those who see, and this is a Lutheran idea too, but the priesthood of all believers, like we are all in ministry, okay? We all minister to people. So as we survey the landscape of what your particular desires are in doing ministry, we want to get behind those who are mature, who have a proven track record of gifting in this area, and we want to try to support them as much as we can. So that was helpful. Thank you. Yes, Bill. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love liturgy. I love the liturgy here. I don't have a huge problem with the liturgical calendar, but I certainly don't think it's necessary. I see the benefits of it, and one of the benefits of it is just a constant exposure to things like Pentecost and the importance of it. I do think sometimes in our reaction against, for example, the charismatic movement, we just don't like to talk about Pentecost. But Pentecost was an amazing event in the history of the church. And to have a liturgical calendar that's constantly going to be highlighting that, constantly highlighting the ascension, constantly highlighting the death of our Lord, and I think that's really good. But you know, I think it's also important, another buzzword, I don't like it, but I'm going to explain it, to be relevant. And sometimes what I've seen in churches that are have a liturgical calendar, kind of like the matters of the church kind of get lost, and it just becomes this theological exercise in the pulpit. And I'm not saying that that would be the case in every church that does liturgical calendars. But so, you know, I'm open to it, but I don't think it's necessary. So would you like to follow up on that? Okay. Yes. Yeah, okay. The church, the evangelical church that I was in California, was about 300. And the church that was in San Diego was about 250, 275. Oh, yeah, yeah. I totally forgot to talk about that. Between 2006 and 2010, when we were in California, we helped plant a Reformed Baptist church. And that church was about, I don't think it ever got bigger than maybe 45. So I've been in 250, 45, another 250 to 300. We were in a church in Louisville that was, again, about 250. Then we went to a small Hispanic church that was probably 45, 50. The church we were in Mexico was maybe 70, maybe, on a busy Sunday. The church we're currently in, again, is about 250, 300. And that's a great question, by the way. I am grateful that I've had exposure to, I've never been in a mega church. I was at John MacArthur's church during my college years, and that was, I don't know, close to 9,000, 10,000 people. They had like two or three services, but nobody knew who I was, and I didn't know who anybody was. But there's a place for those churches. So to answer your question, I do think there comes a point in the life of a church where we need to stop knocking out walls and building bigger buildings and just go plant another church. And the reason why is because it is easy for people to get lost. And that's the last thing in the world that you want as a church. You want to have some type of connection. And I don't believe that means that the pastor has to know every single person. I don't even believe that there's a pastor. I mean, you know, that can be the case, but you have elders. And I don't know that the elders necessarily have to know every single person, but I think that every single person should have exposure to some type of leader. And again, this is where home groups come in. If home group leaders are keyed in to the life of a person, then you have that vital fellowship that I think is important in every single church. So what I've learned is that it's just important to try to have accountability over everyone in your congregation. So for example, if the Lord calls us here, one of the things that I actually, in talking to Ken and Brennan, I think has already been done before, but one of the things that I think is a good idea is breaking up the congregation, dividing the congregation into different elders so that certain elders are over certain people. And then that can be subdivided into like home groups. And so everyone is accounted for. And there is, on a weekly basis or a biweekly basis or whenever the elders have their meetings, just a quick perusal of, you know, are there any concerns that we need to address? Is there anybody that needs encouragement? Is there anybody that needs edification? Is there anybody that needs exhortation? Is there anybody that needs correction, you know? And those are things that are always on our radar. But if the church gets too big and you get people outside these, you know, divisions and subdivisions of leadership, that's where you can have situations where you have somebody on the church rolls for like 20 years that hasn't even been there for 20 years. Just 2 months ago, we were at a congregational meeting in our church, and one of the items on the agenda was to excise people from the church roll. I think it was 7 members who just hadn't been there in 10 years. And we were like, how does that happen? You know, how do people just kind of slip through the cracks? And again, I think it's incumbent upon the leadership to make sure that everybody is connected in some way. So that would be my answer to that question. Being in the different churches that I've been in has highlighted that importance to me, and it's something that is very important to me. So, yeah. My thoughts on singles in the church is they're just as much a part of the church as everybody else. And I'm glad you brought that up because long and the short of it, I think a tendency in churches is to, especially in this age, is to so focus on the family because the very foundations of the family are eroding and being assaulted by everything that's going on in our country that, again, in that overreach to guard the family, we forget about the singles, we forget about the widows, we forget about the divorcees, you know, and it's important as a church that we not forget about them. And so, you know, I think they're a part of the church. I think that I would want to encourage people as much as possible as they're having people over for dinner and having people over for fellowship, that they not forget about the singles, that they include the singles. And then, you know, that the singles pursue people as well. I mean, it's a two-way street, right? You know, as far as having singles ministries and stuff like that, I think that's great, but I think a lot of that can just be absorbed in the life of the church at this point with how many people we have here. So is that helpful? I mean, I don't... Yeah, and I do think there's a place for people not getting married. I think there's a place for women not having children. You know, those are things that, again, in the overreach to guard the family, you sometimes get the impression that, you know, to be a godly woman is to have, you know, 10, 12 children, and that's just not the case. And we have godly examples in the Bible of women who didn't have children, and the Lord used greatly. So yeah, I think it's important just everyone in our congregation to have them connected and see the importance of what they bring to the table, the overall picture. So.
Together and can learn to
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's intentional. Yeah, it's intentional. Yeah, and to be honest, I don't have all the answers to a lot of those things. And again, I would love to engage with y'all and hear what your thoughts are and see how we could serve you in a more specific and efficient manner. Yes. What would I do with respect to, that's that's a good question. So you're asking for specificity, okay? Maybe it'll be the case that, every 2 weeks we'll just have a gathering and I'll meet with you guys and give a little message and do some type of discipling and just kind of get a pulse on what's going on in your life and see how I could pray with you. Maybe we'll have outings where we'll go to the beach and build a huge bonfire and, do those types of things. I'd love to do those types of things. But trying to be intentional about creating venues for you guys where on the one hand, you're getting that robust fellowship and, you're having fun. But on the other hand, it's also serious in the sense that we want to learn about Christ. And if you're confessing Christ, what does that look like for you? And how, again, same as the question with Keiko, how can we serve you where you're at? What are your challenges? Because we all remember what it's like to be in high school. I'm glad I'm not in high school anymore. It's a tough time. And I was not a Christian in high school, so I know that many of us that were not Christians in high school, I'm assuming you're a Christian. We look at you, who's a Christ confessor in high school, and just are so grateful and really admiring what the Lord is doing and want to help you as much as possible. That's going to look different if you're in public school, if you're in private school, if you're homeschooling. So for example, if you're homeschooling and the Lord has regenerated your heart and you confess Christ, then you're not getting the kind of violent attacks from people in the public school. So maybe we need to take you out to some areas where you can get attacked. And I'm serious. One of the greatest advantages I had, I was converted at 18, and then I went directly to community college, and community college rocked me. I took an anthropology class, and I was the only one in the class that believed that God created in 6 days. And the professor took me on, and she's like, "But I've seen that evolution is true." And I said, "You've seen your interpretation of the strata, but that's just your interpretation." And class ended, and this kid followed, well, kid, teenager, young adult, whatever, followed me out, and he was laughing, and he said, "Wait, can I just ask you, you really believe that God created in 6 days?" And I'm like, "Yeah," and he just laughed and walked off. And I love what Brendan said the other day. We were talking about this, and Brendan said, sometimes, it's kind of hard, depending on who I'm talking to let them know that I believe in creation in 6 days, but Bill Nye, the science guy, just toured the Noah's Ark in Kentucky that Ken Ham built. And somebody, the media or whatever, asked him about the origins of life, and he said that we descended from Martians. And he's like, "That's crazy. So, in light of something like that, I don't feel too bad that I believe God created in 6 days, I thought that was a great observation. So my point is, if we, in talking to you, feel like, you really are genuinely converted and you need to be stretched, so let's take you to the beach and we're elders are going to go with you. Let's go share the gospel with somebody. Let's have you talk through those issues and defend your faith. And if you don't have an answer, that's good. That's good, because then we're going to come back. We're going to debrief. We're going to talk about what you could have said, maybe what you shouldn't have said and what was great that you said. And remembering all the time that God is sovereign and he's going to bring into the fold the people that he wants. But you need that. So those are just specific ways that I think we could specifically serve you in the youth. And if the Lord calls us here, I'll be able to kind of cultivate that a little bit more with the elders and the deacons. That's a great question. Thank you. Yes. What's your name?
JD.
JD. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot there. I'll try to bring it all together. Jesus was the most compassionate, loving man, human being that walked the face of the earth. And yet, he told us, as he exemplified this himself, be shrewd as serpents and gentle as doves. Okay? So in the context of our current cultural crisis, and I agree with you, there is a lot of lawlessness, and it's just getting worse. It's not getting better. Love, on the one hand, like I was saying this morning from the text, welcomes anyone who genuinely is seeking the truth. Now, here's the challenge with that. Can you or I always detect if someone is genuinely seeking the truth? No, we can't. But the Lord has given us discernment, and we try through fits and starts and trial and error to test our theories to see if somebody really is. And a lot of times, you know, we're right about those things. And in any given situation, if we determine that a person is just playing games with us, then that's when I think that principle comes in, that we don't cast pearls before swine, and we move on to people who genuinely are concerned. So on the one hand, love welcomes anybody who is desirous to know the truth. And the love part, secondly, comes in that, and this is so important in evangelism, we care more about their souls eternally and even in the meantime than we do about what they think about us, principally whether they want to be our friend or not, okay? And a man that I went to seminary with, I was talking to Keiko about him this morning, a wonderful evangelist, I love him dearly. He's an African-American and grew up in the home of crack addicts. He was 7 years old, watching cartoons in his room, and in the next room, his mom and dad were hitting the crack pipe. I mean, that's just what he grew up in. By God's grace, the Lord saved him in a very dramatic salvation experience. We ended up going to seminary. He was with me at Westminster Seminary. He was a powerful evangelist. He evangelized in downtown San Diego and in L.A., and now he's a minister in the Presbyterian Church. But one of the things he taught me, because he's so bold, he'll just say things to people, and I'm just like, wow, they're probably not going to want to go bowling with you next week. Like, I don't care, you know? Because he said, I care more about their souls than I do about what they think about me. And see, some people can say that's not love. And I say, that's exactly what love is. Do you have children, JD? Okay, so I won't ask you anymore, but I have children and I discipline them. And I've read a book on child rearing that says that I'm an evil monster for doing that. But I read the Bible, which tells me that's where love is. And I tell my child every single time that I discipline him because I want him to love wisdom and not folly. I tell him in two-year-old terms, so I said, wisdom, happy, folly, sad. And he gets that. And discipline comes out of love. So on the one hand, we share the gospel with them because we love them, and we refute their error again because we love them. But, you know, that's a very difficult balance to strike that I'm still trying to learn. And just to give you an example, I mean, I would confront people early on as a young Christian, and it was more out of winning an argument than it was out of true concern for their soul. And so I think one of the things that we need to cultivate in developing our love for people is looking at our own hearts and asking ourselves, why are we engaging in this debate? Why are we engaging in this discussion? What's the end game for us? Are we just trying to be right, or are we genuinely concerned for their souls? And when I'm honest with myself, sometimes I can't say that I'm always concerned about their souls, and that grieves me. But in those moments when that's the case, I'm going to shut up if the Lord can give me the discipline to do so. Because if I'm not going to speak out of love, I in that moment, I just need to not speak and let somebody else who genuinely is concerned about their soul do it. Okay? So with respect to the sexual revolution, this is very, very difficult. And I'm borrowing that phrase from Albert Mohler. That's what he's talking about, or that's what he labels just what's gone on even in the last 2 years. But even if you extend it 5-10 years with essentially the social acceptance of homosexuality. And really, it's not just social acceptance. The homosexuals are the darlings of our age. They could kill somebody and people would applaud them for their courage in doing it as a homosexual. So
I have a friend that I study with at Southern. He's doing his PhD. He used to be, I guess, it's always hard to use terms. You don't never know who you're going to offend, but he used to be a homosexual. He today says he's a gay Christian. I still give him issues with that because I think that's a bad way to say it. But what he means by that is that he as a man still has homosexual tendencies. But he recognizes what the Bible teaches about it. He recognizes that it's wrong. He denounces it. By God's grace, he was able, I don't know how to say this, but to conjure up desires for a woman. He ended up falling in love with a woman, got married. He has three beautiful children. But to this day, he still has some homosexual urges. Okay, but he is one of the most loving guys that I know, so much so that he is invited to conferences of homosexual Christian thinkers that serve as a think tank to think through how homosexuality and Christianity and culture all cohere. He gets invited as kind of the token conservative to give the perspective on how conservatives think about these things. And you know why they invite him? Because he is ironic and he is loving. And that's what we need, you know. People could care less about your pontificating if they think that you don't love them or care about them. And so I'm still learning this myself. So love to me, while on the one hand does not sacrifice truth, it does not compromise, it on the other hand, like Jesus, is gentle as a dove. So it's shrewd as a serpent and gentle as a dove, and it walks like Jesus, and it sounds like Jesus, and it smells like Jesus, and it talks like Jesus. And that's what we want. And that's why all the more we need to hear about Jesus every single Sunday so that we could try to imitate that those characteristics in our discussions and conversations with people. So does that help, JD? Do you have any follow-up questions? Yeah, the bottom line with that is one of the reasons why I'm glad that it happened is it forced me again to see who the true shepherd of the church is, which is Jesus Christ. And not to put so much stock in under-shepherds, which is what pastors are. They are under-shepherds under the chief shepherd, Jesus Christ. And to thirdly, remember and recall and meditate upon and plant my heels in the promise of Matthew 16 that Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. We should never be surprised when leaders fall. We should never be surprised by that. As early as the first century, there were apostates, there were false teachers, there were wolves in sheep's clothing, right? So another thing that I learned out of that is, you know, should you really be surprised? It's discouraging and, you know, it's sad, but I'm not surprised. As John MacArthur would always say, you know, there are a lot of people that are put into leadership that just should have never been put into leadership, you know? So my point to sum it all up is that it helps me to step back, look at the big picture, and remember that Christ is at the helm and he's never going to let go. Can you tell me when you want to call it quits?
About 5 minutes.
Okay.
Last chance. If you have a question, wrap up.
Yeah.
You know, we're a small church, small problems, a lot of time on your hands. Building here, no staff. You know, in those quiet times, okay, when you're left with yourself and the quietness of the building and maybe repeatedly, weeks, months, and stuff like that, how do you see, you know, persevering or challenging yourself to go through that? If you think, Lord willing, it works out, you're here, in the long term. I understand, the first year you want to get to know folks.
And yeah. This question was something of the nature of this question was asked in the Pastoral Search Committee Skype meeting, and the bottom line is there wouldn't be any downtime for me. I mean, in the next 2 years, I'm going to be finishing my dissertation. I'm going to be preparing sermons. I'm going to be thinking about the big picture. I'm going to be mapping out a curriculum for Sunday school. I'm going to be thinking through how I can serve the people in the Bartimaeus house, discipling, just having some type of hand in that if I can, how I could be leading together with my elders, the deacons and the congregation, how we can be coordinating home groups. I mean, there's plenty to do. But more importantly than that is I parse Hebrew verbs. That's what I do. That keeps me busy, is parsing Hebrew verbs, okay? And if you don't know what that means, every time I read a text with my professors or with anybody that I'm studying with, we're asked to parse Hebrew verbs, and it's the hardest thing to do. But I do it because I want to be able to read the Bible in Technicolor so that I could preach it in Technicolor rather than black and white, and that's going to keep me busy too. So that's not going to be what I do most of the time, but it's going to be what I do a lot of the time. Every text that I preach, I'm going to look at it from the original and try to understand what the Holy Spirit desires for the church here in Virginia Beach to hear from that particular text. And then apart from that, I'm going to be praying. I mean, I want to and need to be praying for the needs of my people. So I don't see a lot of downtime. I mean, I could be really naive, but I don't really see any downtime. So I hope that answers your question, and I hope I'm right. Yeah, but I don't plan on working on that during when I'm on the clock here. So that's going to be in my own free time. I guess the best way to answer your question, Scott, is we always need to be forward thinking. And any downtime, quote unquote, that there would be, it's going to be filled up with thinking ahead. And I've had the wonderful privilege of sitting under leaders who have modeled this before me in such a wonderful way that it's had a huge impression upon me. And I would say before I said it unto them, I was not one who was forward thinking. I'm just like, what's the next text? I'm going to preach it, and then that's it. There's so much more to ministry than that, so much more. And that's what I want to be about. I want to be about thinking not only in the now but ahead, and then also looking to the community. I'll just say this lastly. The gentleman that I mentioned that I went to seminary with, the African-American who was a bold evangelist, name's Leon Brown. He's actually here in Virginia somewhere. I don't know exactly where, but he planted a church here in Virginia. And he just had like a kind of a community forum on race and religion because he's really into engaging the current racial divide, we'll just say, in the society and trying to wrestle with what the voice of the church should be in that. So he just recently had a forum, and the place was packed out. And I'm willing to bet you that there were a bunch of people in there that weren't even believers, that were just interested. You know, what does the church have to say about Black Lives Matter? You know? What does the church have to say about police brutality? You know? And you know, personally for me on things like that, again, it's a thing that I want to talk through with my elders, but we have to be careful about that. But you know what? That'll draw people in. You know, let's have a forum on homosexuality and see them all come in and preach the gospel at the end. Wouldn't that be awesome? See? Not for a church service. You know, you do it midweek or something like that. But again, getting back to Jeremy's question, that's a great way that we could bring people in. Another thing that we've thought about is, don't you know that families in the area, believer and non-believer, but even specifically non-believer, are struggling with how to raise teenage children, are struggling with how to parent their kids, are struggling with how to manage their money, et cetera, et cetera. Does God's word have wisdom for all those things? Absolutely. So how about a conference free where we provide lunch for everybody that comes on what does God's word have to say about raising children? Free. Come. And we surround them and we pursue them with love, the grace covenant way, as it were. And they're just like, wow, these Christians are kind of cool. You know, maybe I'll come back, you know. So I want to be thinking about those things and see if the Lord is pleased to use that to grow our church and expand the kingdom.
The first impression, what did coming into the church, seeing
You know what, to be honest, Scott, I mean, this is, it's kind of hard to imagine what it would be like, but I mean, we got a little sampling of the church through the pastoral search committee, and I believe that the sampling we got there was properly representative of what we've experienced here. So, Aaron had a question, so I want to go ahead and hit that real quick, if you don't mind.
I've had the pleasure of living in eight different states.
Hmm. Are you in the service? Are you in the military?
No.
Okay.
No, just
okay. Sure, yeah.
And they take victories all the time. Churches are dying left and right. And, you know, protecting your flock against a violent enemy on the spiritual plane, how does that translate again? You know, it's one thing to talk about bringing in or having an open discussion on
it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who did you say was the biggest group in the area? I missed that part.